My name is Anthony King, and I'm telling the stories behind your favorite cop movies. This is the all-new Neon Badges. David Fincher was born on August 28, 1962 in Denver, Colorado. His mother was a mental health nurse who worked in drug addiction programs, and his father was an author who worked as a reporter and bureau chief for Life magazine. When David was 2 years old, the family moved to San Anselmo, California, where it just so happened their neighbor was a man named George Lucas. David was like any other kid, busy and active, but unlike many kids, he was bitten by a bug called film. At 8 years old, Fincher saw a documentary on the making of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. He says, "It had never occurred to me that movies didn't take place in real time. I knew that they were fake. I knew that the people were acting, but it had never crossed my mind that it could take 4 months to make a movie." In that documentary, it showed the entire company with all these rental horses and moving trailers to shoot a scene on top of a train. They'd hire somebody who looked like Robert Redford to jump onto the train. It never occurred to me that there were hours between each of these shots. The actual circus of it was invisible, as it should be, but in seeing that, I became obsessed with the idea of how. It was the ultimate magic trick. I thought that there'd never be anything that'd be as interesting as that to do with the rest of my life.
No, not yet. Not until me and Harvey get the rules straightened out.
Rules? In a knife fight? No rules.
Well, if there ain't gonna be any rules, let's get the fight started. Someone count 1, 2, 3, go.
1, 2, 3, go.
In his teens, Fincher attended high school in Ashland, Oregon, where he directed plays and designed sets and lighting after school. He was also a projectionist at a second-run movie theater as well as a production assistant at the local TV station in Medford, Oregon. After graduating high school, he moved to Los Angeles and got a job with John Cordy doing different types of special effects for movies like Twice Upon a Time. It just so happened Fincher was working alongside his old neighbor, George Lucas, who then hired Fincher to work at Industrial Light and Magic as an assistant cameraman and matte photographer on Return of the Jedi and Temple of Doom. The next year, Fincher left ILM to direct a television commercial for the American Cancer Society. In that commercial, they had a fetus smoking a cigarette. Very strange stuff, but that somehow got him his next gig as the director of Rick Springfield's documentary, The Beat of the Live Drum. This sent Fincher down the road of commercials and music videos for several years, where he co-founded the production company Propaganda Films, which specialized in those types of media. Names like Bay, Fuqua, Gondry, Proyas, Snyder, and Verbinski all got their starts at Propaganda Films before moving on to feature films. During this time, Fincher directed commercials for some of the biggest brands in the world. Levi's, Converse, Nike, Pepsi, Revlon, Sony, Coca-Cola, and Chanel. Although he loathed doing them, it paid the bills and he learned a lot. The Beat of the Live Drum also gave Fincher an in at the beginning of the music video boom in the 1980s. He would end up directing videos for Springfield, The Outfield, Eddie Money, Patti Smith, Mark Knopfler, Loverboy, Foreigner, Sting, and Steve Winwood. He also directed several now iconic videos, including Paula Abdul's Straight Up, Aerosmith's Janie's Got a Gun, Billy Idol's Cradle of Love, and Madonna's Express Yourself, Oh Father, and Vogue. Between 1984 and 1993, Fincher directed 53 music videos. And since he never had a formal education, this was his film school by learning how to work fast and cheap. But then came Alien 3.
Don't be afraid. I'm part of the family.
In 1990, 20th Century Fox hired Fincher to replace Vincent Ward as the director for Alien 3, which would be his first feature. Production and the fight between Fincher and the studio was famously awful, leaving a horrid taste in his mouth about directing films. It was baptism by fire, he says. No one hated it more than me. To this day, no one hates it more than me. After his painful experience on Alien 3, Fincher really backed off from reading scripts and directing films. He recalls, "I thought I'd rather die of colon cancer than do another movie." So we went back to commercials and music videos. Coca-Cola, Levi's, the Rolling Stones, he was able to make some money, flex some creative muscles, and plan his next move. A year and a half passed before Fincher had read a script, but then his agent called.
"I'm sending something over. You have to read it."
So he did. Fincher called his agent back. "You're right. Fuck, this is great. The ending, with the head in the box, it's brilliant." There was a couple seconds of silence, and then his agent says,
"Head in the box? Wait, fuck! I sent you the wrong draft!"
Okay, hold on a minute. Let's back up. Before Fincher, before Head in the Box, before Fuck Wrong Draft, Andrew Kevin Walker, the writer of Seven, was born and raised in Pennsylvania, and after graduating high school, he attended Penn State University to pursue a career in film production. He got his bachelor's in film and video and then moved to New York City. Walker quickly realized how unhappy he was living in New York. He was working at Tower Records and writing screenplays here and there for a company called Bryson Entertainment, stuff like Brain Scan and Abusement Park. He was tired of that junk, though, so he sat down one night and started writing something for himself. Usually a meticulous outliner, Walker had no plans for this particular story. He just started writing. He says, "I hated my time in New York, but if I hadn't lived there, I probably wouldn't have written Seven." He says that he was just in an exploitational mindset at the time and felt like he was writing how he really felt about the city. It's his love letter to New York City. As things moved along with his new story, he started taking it seriously. Now, Walker is a huge proponent of research, so he'd read books about cops and learn that they rarely ever pull their firearms. On white people, of course, or how most cases go unsolved. So he'd look at the cliches of horror and cop movies and tried to go to the opposite direction in his script. He read books on serial killers and discovered there's a fine line when you start researching why serial killers actually kill. But it was the pattern of these killers that attracted him. That pattern, he says, lends itself nicely to storytelling. As far as the Seven Deadly Sins goes, it's not like Walker sat down and read everything St. Thomas Aquinas wrote. Instead, he opted for Dante, which, incidentally, is the book Somerset reads and copies at the library in Seven. Walker would just be walking down the streets of New York, and everywhere he turned, he saw an example of one of the sins. So after about 5 years in New York, he moved to the opposite side of the country to try sell a screenplay, and eventually contacted screenwriter David Koepp. Walker gave his script to Koepp, who in turn got it into the hands of Michael DeLuca at New Line Cinema, who thought the script was different and totally original. It seemed inventive and fresh. DeLuca loved the character arc of Somerset, the John Doe mystery, and how each death seemed to top the previous one. "I had no idea what was going to happen next," he says. "It kept me on my toes. I loved it." Now, this is New Line in the early 90s. Started in Bob Shea's New York apartment in the 60s, they were primarily known for producing and distributing horror and exploitation movies. John Waters' Multiple Maniacs, Female Trouble, Desperate Living, Polyester and Hairspray, Alone in the Dark, Critters, The Hidden. And let's not forget, this was the house that Freddy built, for God's sakes. DeLuca's first job with New Line was on Leatherface, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3. Around the same time, he had a pile of screenplays on his desk. The one on top was about these two cops chasing a serial killer committing his crimes based on the Seven Deadly Sins. And it ended with a head in the box. "It was the perfect fit for us," says DeLuca. But that screenplay and its ending would be poked and prodded and changed back again for the next 3 years. Plus, they needed to find the money.
"Maybe Arnold Copleson could help us out.
The right actors to play these roles.
Is Pacino free? What about Denzel?
And most importantly, a director.
Call Jeremiah Chechik."
Copleson agreed to front the money. Pacino, Gene Hackman, and Robert Duvall all turned down the role of the older detective Somerset. Walker was actually picturing William Hurt as Somerset was writing it, but it never got farther than that. So New Line turned to Morgan Freeman. Freeman had been interested in drama since childhood, but as a young adult ended up joining the Air Force as an automatic tracking radar repairman. After his 4 years were up, he moved to Los Angeles and started taking acting lessons at the Pasadena Playhouse, and then later dance lessons in San Francisco. His professional career began as a dancer, actually, at the 1964 World's Fair, followed by becoming a member of the opera ring in San Francisco. Freeman appeared on and off Broadway and broke out in the children's show The Electric Company, although he considers his Oscar-nominated role in Street Smart to be his breakout. He had bit parts in movies and TV throughout the 70s and 80s, but really garnered success on stage, where he won Obie Awards for his roles in Coriolanus, The Gospel at Colonus, and Driving Miss Daisy, and then a drama desk for The Mighty Gents. It wasn't until 1989, though, that he became a household name for films like Lean on Me, Johnny Handsome, Driving Miss Daisy, which earned him an Oscar nomination, and Glory. He followed those with Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, Unforgiven, The Shawshank Redemption, another Oscar nom, and Outbreak. Now, Denzel turned down the role of the younger cop Mills, which he says he regrets. During the time Denzel was considered, though, Jeremiah Chechik had been tapped as the director, and the two of them, along with producer Phyllis Carlisle, sat down to develop the script, meaning they were going to change things to suit their own tastes and styles and opinions of what they thought the public wanted. Fincher recalls it being more of a kick-ass, take-names type of story at that point, but Denzel eventually walked away, so producers turned to Brad Pitt. A Midwestern boy, Pitt always had that sexy farm boy look to him. I think it was Elric Kane from Pure Cinema Podcast that called Pitt a character actor in a movie star's body. Pitt landed his first leading role in The Dark Side of the Sun in 1988, which was shelved until 97, so Cutting Class ends up being his first movie to hit the theaters. He gained wider recognition in Thelma and Louise, defining him as a sex symbol, and hit even bigger with A River Runs Through It. He followed those with California, and then a small role in True Romance. Then the year before Seven, Brad Pitt became a movie star with Interview with the Vampire and Legends of the Fall. So here's where they stood. Copulson was in as the money guy. Pacino was out, but they had Morgan Freeman. Denzel was out, but Brad Pitt was in. Chechik was out, but Fincher? Maybe. See, they didn't exactly know what was going on there. Remember, his agent had sent him the wrong draft of the script. He was supposed to get the kick-ass Take Names draft, but instead got the first draft of Walker's screenplay. So New Line sent Fincher the latest draft to Seven. He read it and hated it. It was too late. He'd already fallen in love with the head-in-the-box ending, which New Line had rejected something like 9 drafts previously. Fincher says, "I hate knowing things will be okay when I'm watching a movie, and that's the feeling I was getting from this new draft. The draft I first fell in love with was about a man watching another man in his youthful exuberance become embroiled in something he's not prepared to deal with. It was a Somerset story, not a Mills story. The draft I fell in love with always kept the audience off balance. This new one felt too comfortable." So Fincher eventually agreed to direct, though, just as long as nothing was off the table. He was going to fight for that head in the box ending. But overall, he still loved the script. It was like a connect-the-dots movie that delivers the inhumanity, he says. It's psychologically violent. It implies so much, not about why you did it, but how you did it. Mike DeLuca agreed, and he preferred the original ending as well. That was the movie we were going to make, he says. But now they had to convince their money man, Arnold Copulson. DeLuca told Fincher,
"Do not tell Arnold this is what we're doing. You gotta pitch to him."
So Fincher met with Copulson, pitched him the first draft, and Copulson says, "No way! It'll never end with the head in the box. I won't allow it." Fincher could have easily just walked away at that point. So pre-production proceeded as usual. Copulson thinking he's making one movie, Fincher and everyone else, including Morgan Freeman and Brad Pitt, thinking they're making another movie. The problem was, Fincher and everyone else needed Copulson to make their movie. Pitt even said he wouldn't do the movie if it didn't end with the head in the box, but none of that mattered to Copulson. So 2 months before principal photography began, Fincher met with Copulson one more time. He said, "Arnold, listen, 50 years from now, somebody at a party is going to be talking about the head in the box movie. They're not going to remember just another police procedural, but they will remember that head in the box. And once you know it, that son of a bitch finally agreed." With Freeman and Pitt on board, the rest of the cast started to fall into place. The role of Tracy, Mills' wife, was first offered to Christina Applegate, but she turned it down and instead went to Gwyneth Paltrow. She wasn't the Gwyneth Paltrow we know now, but she had slowly been making a name for herself. And Paltrow and Pitt were dating at the time and already had good natural chemistry, so the importance of their relationship on screen was already apparent to audiences. Walker's goal with Tracy when he was writing her was to have her be there just enough so you wouldn't forget about her, but not so much that you'd know she'd be a target. John Doe was a little harder to cast, see. The role's never going to be an above-the-title type of actor, or so thought the studio. Fincher and Pitt had other ideas, though. Arlie Ermey came in to read for John Doe. Now, take a second here and just imagine this movie with Arlie Ermey in that role.
"You will be a weapon. You will be a minister of death praying for war. But until that day, you are pukes. You are the lowest form of life on earth. You are not even human fucking beings. You are nothing but unorganized, grabastic pieces of amphibian shit."
Thankfully, he was given the role of the police captain. Fincher and Pitt wanted Kevin Spacey for Doe. He was big at this point. The same year Seven came out, another film would come out, earning him an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor, The Usual Suspects. Walker created John Doe as plain as possible, someone who could just disappear into the wallpaper of the city, a man without an apathetic reflex. Everyone knew Spacey was a perfect person for this role, but the studio couldn't afford him. They said no way. But Fincher and Pitt battled once again and never relented. With time closing in on day one of principal photography, a few things still needed ironed out. The script, for example. For the second to final scene where Somerset and Mills are driving Doe out to the desert, Fincher worked hard to make sure there were 3 separate opinions in that car. And he wanted to make sure the audience would be able to find something in all 3 to agree with. And that ending, the studio suggested maybe it should be one of Mills' dog's heads in the box.
"Absolutely not,"
said everyone else. Just before production began, Fincher sat down with Pitt and Spacey. He told him, What we're about to make here is going to be a lurid footnote in your career. It's not going to be the greatest thing you ever make, but if we do this properly, it's going to be something we'll all be incredibly proud of. And off they went. Production began in December of 1994, and despite the rainy and ambiguousness of the location, it was all shot in California. Fincher says, "Seven is the first time I got to carry through certain things about the camera, and about what movies are, or can be." And in order to do that, and to set the tone he was going for, Fincher aligned himself with two key members of his team, cinematographer Darius Kanji and production designer Arthur Max. Fincher wanted to show a city that was dirty, violent, polluted, and often depressing, visually and stylistically. So everything needed to be as authentic and raw as possible. Enter Arthur Max. He was charged with creating a dismal world that often eerily mirrored its inhabitants. Max says, "We created a setting that reflects the moral decay of the people in it. Everything has fallen apart and nothing is working properly." Max and Fincher designed each crime scene to mirror the victims and the sin on which their respective murder was based. And Max took it even further by tailoring each interior design to the victims, echoing a diverse society. And they tried as hard as they could to keep color out of the crime scenes in order for the blood to pop out more. In his script, Walker says he just tried to imagine the most horrible things possible when creating each death, which ultimately aided Max and Fincher in their design. For instance, the gluttony scene, which was based on real-life crime scene photos of a suicide. The set dressers went in a week before the shoot and splashed tomato sauce on the walls. As you can imagine, the smell was absolutely putrid the day the crew came into film. Details that wouldn't especially be noticeable on screen had to be there to project an overall feeling on audiences. Take the police station or the library. Those were sets, believe it or not. Max and his team designed them in order to speak to the history of the city, whatever city it was, and what came before its present-day inhabitants. It needed that noir quality. Now let's journey into John Doe's apartment for a sec. Max and Fincher made Doe's lair like a cave that goes deeper and deeper. The windows were all painted over and then had scratches on them like hieroglyphics. And Walker tried to make sure whatever was in his script made logical sense. The aspirin bottles. John Doe constantly had headaches, which led to his collection of empty bottles, because he's an obsessive. The windows were all painted over. John Doe was a recluse. Plus, New York apartments are so close together anyways. And then there's a pommel horse in there, whether you see it in the film or not, because Doe needed to get his exercise. That was all a production designer's dream. Max was able to go wild in the minutiae of each scene. And then there was the red neon cross in John Doe's apartment. Aside from maybe surface level reasons, it was a source of light for Kanji. They couldn't use natural daylight and didn't want to simulate it, so they used any and all types of light sources they could think of. Fluorescents, incandescents, neons, flashlights, you name it. It all helped to create the atmosphere needed to set the perfect tone of the film. Fincher and Kanji approached Seven like a tiny genre movie, the kind of movie Friedkin might have made after The Exorcist. They adopted a simple approach to the camera work influenced by the TV show Cops, like how the camera is in the back seat peering over people's shoulders. Fincher used the Cops reference again when working with Max. They didn't want any more room than would be there in real life. Confined spaces became the normal, which is one of the reasons Kanji primarily shot on one camera.
There are 2,000 notebooks on these shelves, and each notebook contains about 250 pages.
Get it? Anything about the killings?
What sick, ridiculous puppets we are, and what a gross little stage we dance on. What fun we have, dancing, fucking, not a care in the world, not knowing that we are nothing. We are not what was intended. No, wait, there's a lot more. On the subway today, a man came up to me to start a conversation. Made small talk, this lonely man talking about the weather and other things. I tried to be pleasant and accommodating, but my head began to hurt from his banality. I almost didn't notice it had happened, but I suddenly threw up all over him. He was not pleased, and I couldn't stop laughing. No dates. Placed on the shelves in no discernible order. Just his mind poured out on paper.
Now, let's take a minute to shout out some of the bit players in Seven. First off, you have the writer, Andrew Kevin Walker, as the first dead body you see in the movie. You have guys like Reggie Cathy as the medical examiner, Mark Boone Jr. as the sleazy FBI agent that helps out Somerset and Mills. There's Leland Orser as the victim at the sex club who kills the prostitute with a giant blade strapped to a dildo. Fincher remembers how Orser would sit in the corner between takes and hyperventilate himself in order to get to the place he needed to be. And then there's John C. McGinley, maybe the most intense guy to ever show up in a movie, as the SWAT leader. As usual, well, there there is plenty of fun to be had on set. In the film, the mill's apartment shakes whenever an elevated train passes by. That set was built on risers that were powered by these gas motors that shook the whole platform. Whenever someone new would wander onto stage, the crew would power up the motors, and the whole set would shake, causing that person to shit their pants. With the fun, though, inevitably comes trouble. Brad Pitt says the most fun he's ever had filming is during the chase scene between Mills and Doe. He calls it the goods. I mean, what do you hate most about chases, he says, when the guy knows exactly where the other guy is, right? So we did it like I was terrified coming around every corner. Mills doesn't want to get shot. I think that made the scene play out more realistically. But after that scene, we see Mills with a cast, remember? We're meant to believe he injured it during his fall from the fire escape. What really happened is that while shooting the scene, Pitt's jumping from car to car. And remember, it's always raining. So he's jumping cars, and on one take, he slips and falls ass first through a windshield. But he was so in the moment and wanted to keep rolling, so he pushes himself up and keeps running. Fincher calls cut. Pitt looks down at his arm, and he's covered in blood. What happened was he ended up cutting his hand so badly on the broken windshield, he nearly severed the tendons in three fingers. So Pitt ends up having surgery. They put a cast on his arm, and Fincher and Walker have to write Mills' injury into the script on the fly. The role of the janitor towards the beginning of the film, who's taken Somerset's name off his door, is played by a man named George Christie. Now, Christie was a society columnist for The Hollywood Reporter for many, many years. One of the producers asked Fincher if his friend could be in the movie. Nothing big, the janitor part maybe. Yeah, whatever, says Fincher. So come the day of the scene, Christie is an hour late for shoot. Fincher yells, "Where the fuck is this guy?" Come to find out, the studio had sent a car to pick up Christie. Fincher has no idea who this guy is, remember? So he says, "Why the hell would they send a car to pick up an extra?" Turns out, Christie had stopped for coffee and was chatting up the people in the cafe. Now came time to shoot the final sequence out in the desert. They picked a location with all the electrical wires for logical reasons. John Doe knew Somerset's radio wouldn't work under those wires. What Fincher wasn't counting on was that that was actually true. He'd be up there in the helicopter with cameraman Harris Savitas, and they wouldn't be able to communicate with the crew on the ground. So Fincher would have to call the base camp on one of those old brick-like cell phones, and then base camp, miles away, would then radio the ground crew. There ended up being something like a 2-minute delay every time he gave a damn direction. And it was 120 degrees that day. So hot, in fact, that the helicopter wasn't able to lift off at first. Fincher remembers Savitas sitting in the chopper, soaked through his clothes, sweat cascading off his head, saying, "This is my idea of hell." And all those shots from the helicopter were filmed after principal photography had wrapped. New Line didn't think those shots were necessary initially and said,
"Give us what you have, and if we think the picture needs them, we'll give you some more money."
Turns out the picture needed them. So since Freeman, Pitt, and Spacey were already done, they had to call in doubles. And then those shots of McGinley and the helicopter were actually filmed on the ground to save money. They would just turn the rotors on and Savitas would shake the camera by hand. It was so stupid, says Fincher. As far as acting that scene, Freeman says he had never had to act like he'd just seen something as horrible as someone's head in the box before. He said it took a long time to dig within himself and find whatever it was he needed to be able to react that way. On top of that, Freeman had fallen off a horse shortly before filming and injured himself. So while filming the sequence where he's running towards a delivery van, he ends up re-injuring himself so badly that he needs to wear a brace for 4 years afterwards. And technical things still got in the way. The gun. It would never fire properly. They did half a dozen takes of Mills shooting Doe, and the gun actually fired once. Pitt says, "I might as well have made gun sounds with my mouth." Pew, pew. Principal photography had wrapped just before Christmas of 1994, and after 55 total days, production was wrapped in March of 95. Now, there are three important takeaways from post-production: the opening credit sequence, the color bleaching process of the film, and the coda added at the end. And we'll start with the color bleaching process. Seven is known for its very specific dark look. This was achieved through a chemical process called bleach bypass. In this process, the silver in the actual film stock isn't completely removed. This then creates deep, dark, shadowy images on the negative of the film. This could all be done digitally today, sure, but there's something about doing this to actual celluloid that achieves a richness you just can't fake. Now, mix that with Arthur Max's near total elimination of color in the death scenes, and you have something completely unique that hasn't been reached to this day, in my opinion. Now, for the opening credit sequence, there are three main people here: Kyle Cooper, the title designer, and Clive Piercy and John Sable, the designers of John Doe's notebooks. Clive Piercy was a graphic designer who had previously done work for the BBC, the LA Times, Nike, Quicksilver, and had even designed the cover art for Elton John's album Too Low for Zero. John Sable was an art director and calligrapher who would go on to become the executive vice president of creative print for Walt Disney Studios. Fincher hired them both to come up with the overall design for the thousands of notebooks with which John Doe has filled his apartment. Fincher and Arthur Max were very specific and knew exactly what they wanted, an obsessive quality in Doe's handwriting. It was Piercy and Sable who were charged with getting it there. Sable would sit for hours upon hours and handwrite all the notebooks shown. It was painful, he says, not just from the physical act of writing, but having to write the disgusting, vitriolic copy Fincher wanted. Piercy and Sable would be as meticulous as possible. They'd search high and low for old photographs. They'd find envelopes of photos from the 50s, yellowed and warm, and paste them onto the pages of the notebooks. There's a tear-stained suicide note written to a father Sable found and put in there. He'd then take these disgusting photos he found at Kinko's and have them copy and transfer them onto plastic film, and would get these terrified looks from the employees. Piercy would then bake the notebooks in an oven at a low temperature to add color and character. They wanted to make it as fucked up as possible and then force Fincher to decide if he wanted to actually show this stuff on film. Spoilers, of course he did. Now, the original idea for the opening title sequence was to show Somerset buy a house out in the country and then travel back to the city on the train, while simply running titles over everything. The problem was they didn't have any more money to shoot. Piercy and Sable had already designed and created John Doe's notebooks, so Fincher had an idea. Kyle Cooper had been designing titles since the late 80s on movies like Bird on a Wire, Body Parts, Indecent Proposal, True Lies, and Braveheart, but this was going to be a completely new way of doing things. The plan was to use a remix version of Closer by Nine Inch Nails. Since he was already a pro at it, Fincher wanted to shoot it almost like a music video. He wanted it to look like John Doe was filling out his notebooks, show close-ups of the obsessive handwritten work Sable had done, show the grotesque pictures he and Piercy had found. Cooper then took that idea and ran with it. He'd find random things in his apartment to include his visuals. Fish hooks, hair dug out of his shower drain, rusty razor blades. So Cooper had storyboarded and worked out the entire title sequence, sent it to Fincher, and Fincher goes,
"This is perfect. I love it. I'm going to get Romanek to direct this."
Now, Mark Romanek is the director of iconic music videos such as En Vogue's Free Your Mind, Lenny Kravitz's Are You Gonna Go My Way, Madonna's Rain, and Michael Jackson's Scream. Oh, by the way, he also directed the Nine Inch Nails Closer video, which just happened to be the song playing over the title sequence they were creating. Cooper, though, protested and said he wanted to direct the title sequence. So Fincher obliged, and Cooper, along with editor Angus Wall and cinematographer Harris Savitas, filmed the sequence. Now, in your standard analog cinema cameras, the actual film hooks onto little pegs called registration pins. Those pins keep the film stable when you're shooting a movie or taking pictures. Cooper and Savitas took the registration pins and the shutter, the thing that allows light into the camera, out of the camera to give that title sequence that very specific, frantic look. Fincher only had one direction for him.
How fucked up can we make it?
Howard Shore knocked the score out, Richard Francis Bruce cut the film together, and Fincher met with Copelson to show him what they had made. Now, what Fincher showed Copelson in that screening room is not what we saw in the theater. What we see is Mills being hauled away in the back of the police cruiser, and Somerset and his captain talking about seeing each other on Monday. What Copelson saw was Mills shoot Doe, and then blackout. The lights go up in the screening room, and Copelson's head is in his hands. He says,
"Oh my God, they took a perfectly good genre movie and turned it into a foreign film."
DeLuca, on the other hand, loved that ending. That wasn't the only ending considered, though. In Walker's original script, Somerset takes out his knife to throw at Mills to keep him from killing Doe, but Mills shoots Somerset in the shoulder before turning the gun on Doe. Then there was an idea that Somerset kills Doe instead, in self-sacrifice, so Mills wouldn't have to go to jail. But Fincher was adamant on sticking with his ending. Gunshots, blackout, so that's what they sent to the National Research Group for a test screening. Now, NRG got people to come to the test screening by advertising it as
Seven, starring Brad Pitt from Legends of the Fall, and Morgan Freeman from Driving Miss Daisy.
Can you think of two films less like Seven? And that's exactly what happened. Those are the people who showed up to watch this dark crime thriller. So Fincher gives NRG very specific instructions on what to do when the film ends. You have to leave the lights down at least 10 seconds before handing out your stupid comment cards.
"Sure, no problem,"
they say. So, gunshots, blackout, Lights immediately go up. It completely ruined the environment for the audience to absorb what had just happened. It was an absolutely disastrous screening, says Fincher. He also remembers standing out in the lobby hearing some lady walk out of the theater saying,
"The people who made that movie should be killed."
After the national tragedy of the first test screening, everyone involved knew they needed good word-of-mouth advertising for this movie, which meant that original ending had to go, or at least be expanded upon. So that's why we get what we get. And so as not to go on the most dire of notes, they add the voiceover coda of Freeman reading the Hemingway quote. "It was only bronzing a dead lily," says Fincher.
Ernest Hemingway once wrote, "The world is a fine place and worth fighting for." I agree with the second part.
Seven opened on September 22, 1995, across 2,400 theaters against Paul Verhoeven's Showgirls. It held the top spot at the box office with $13.9 million its first weekend and stayed number one for four more weeks. When all was said and done, Seven ended its run with a worldwide gross of more than $327 million. Gene Siskel of the Chicago Tribune gave the film 3 out of 4 stars. Brad Pitt and Morgan Freeman are terrific as detectives following the trail of a serial killer who wants to make a point about the seven deadly sins. The results of the killings are needlessly grotesque and don't really serve the smart screenplay by Andrew Kevin Walker and the artful direction of David Fincher. Kevin Spacey plays a Silence of the Lambs type killer, and all of this talent is worth seeing if you can look past the gruesome details. Also from the Tribune, Michael Wilmington was mixed, leaning more to the negative side with 2.5 stars. Freeman's owlish savvy and Pitt's twitchy cool make even the unlikeliest scenes ring with emotion and conflict. Unfortunately, most of the scenes in Seven are unlikely, which means that by the end of the movie, the duo is battling not just an insane killer, but an off-the-wall screenwriter. Andrew Kevin Walker is putting hackneyed dialogue on their lips and impossible motivations in their souls. Seven is so visually stunning and dramatically puerile that it often thrills and exasperates simultaneously. The crumbling walls, dark rooms, and streets awash in rain all make a nifty modern equivalent for the stylized shadows of film noir. But the story is the kind of witless thriller fable, derived almost wholly from other movies and TV, that can't suspend our disbelief, or even make a dent in it. There's an eighth deadly sin wreaking more damage here than the others put together. Poor script judgment. Why waste actors like Freeman, Pitt, and Gwyneth Paltrow on material like this? In the fetid gloom of this movie, the plot just seems loonier the more it unwinds and graphic bloody squalor more deeply unpleasant. And from the Chicago Sun-Times, Roger Ebert praised the movie. Seven is one of the darkest and most merciless films ever made in the Hollywood mainstream. The enigma of Somerset's character is at the heart of the film, and this is one of Morgan Freeman's best performances. What could become a routine cop movie is elevated by the evocation of dread mythology and symbolism. Seven is not really a very deep or profound film, but it provides the convincing illusion of one. Almost all mainstream thrillers seek first to provide entertainment. This one intends to fascinate and appall. Somerset and Mills represent established fiction formulas. Mills is the fish out of water, they're an odd couple, and together they're the old hand and the greenhorn. The actors and the dialogue by Andrew Kevin Walker enrich the formulas with specific details in Freeman's precise, laconic speech. The actor who plays John Doe, whom I won't spoil, has a big assignment. He embodies evil. Like Hannibal Lecter, his character must be played by a strong actor who projects not merely villainy, but twisted psychological complexities. Observe his face. Smug, self-satisfied. Listen to his voice, intelligent, analytical. Mark his composure and apparent fearlessness. The film essentially depends on him and would go astray if the actor faltered. He doesn't. Ultimately, critics and audiences liked Seven, and Richard Francis Bruce was even nominated for an Oscar for his editing. After Seven, Andrew Kevin Walker went on to write screenplays for films like Joel Schumacher's 8mm, Tim Burton's Sleepy Hollow, and The Wolfman starring Benicio del Toro. Brad Pitt... Well, I don't need to tell you about Brad Pitt. He becomes one of, if not the biggest movie stars in the world. Producer Arnold Copelson is quoted saying, "We haven't seen a movie star like him since the 40s. Pitt has been nominated for 7 Academy Awards, 2 of those as producer, winning one for 12 Years a Slave, and winning one for Best Supporting Actor for Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Morgan Freeman has been nominated for 5 Oscars, 3 I've already mentioned, plus Million Dollar Baby, which he won for Supporting Actor, and Invictus. He's currently the narrator of All of Our Lives. After 7, David Fincher continued directing music videos for artists like The Wallflowers, A Perfect Circle, Nine Inch Nails, and Justin Timberlake. He'd keep on directing commercials for a few years as well for companies like Calvin Klein and Levi's. And despite having a nightmare of a time on the set of Alien 3, Fincher kept reading those scripts and keeps directing. He followed Seven with The Game, Fight Club, Panic Room, and Zodiac, and then he garnered 2 directing Oscar nominations with The Curious Case of Benjamin Button and The Social Network. Fincher also made his way into television, directing and producing shows like House of Cards and Mindhunter. Why are so many in the film industry migrating to the television side of things? Fincher says, there's not much room for characterization in films anymore, so it's moving to TV because we have more time with these characters. Writer Andrew Kevin Walker thinks the success of Seven was due in part to the audiences being surprised. The beaten path was extremely beaten, he says. It defied what they expected of the genre. We just tried to go against expectations. Even Brad Pitt says being in Seven is as close to being in a perfect film as possible. One of the most profound things about the production was how Morgan Freeman allowed David Fincher to direct him. Freeman usually prefers directors to back off and just let him do his thing. A director doesn't usually tell an actor how to act anyways, just as an actor doesn't tell a director how to direct. But Fincher was so specific and knew exactly what he wanted in their initial meetings that Freeman was impressed and let him take charge, and now considers himself a Fincher devotee. Morgan has an incredible empathy and this incredibly evolved relationship to human frailty, says Fincher. Pitt shares his sentiments. He carries this wisdom with him that is so apparent. And to close out this episode of Neon Badges, I'll leave you with some wisdom from David Fincher. The serial killer does not a genre make. They're cop movies. Seven is all about the psychological trauma John Doe is inflicting on the audience. It's a psychic attack movie that forces you to think. If you could poke a soft spot of someone's fear center, you'll get the reaction you're going for. My heartfelt thanks go out to you, the listeners, for your support. You're all remarkable people. You can follow me on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd @AK Donnelly. That's 1N, 2 L's. My name is Anthony King, and I'll see y'all next time.